But we get the 5 o'clock hour underway as we do each and every Tuesday by welcoming to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, Meathead Say the Realest Things, is available everywhere. Hello there, Colin.
I was wondering how this was going to work with Carrie's trip, his photos from the road. So it's like a bit of a wild card factor today when the phone rings. Is he going to be ringing me out from Louisiana, or is it Kimball doing double duty?
It's me doing double duty, but Don Cook's in here helping me. He's basically my safety net in case it all goes wrong. But yeah, so far, so good. Nothing's broken yet.
I'm the blanket to his Linus right now.
It's 40-plus years you've been doing radio. I figure a guy like you can pretty much do everything at this point.
Well, you know, that's what I want Carrie to think, too, and keep that in mind the next time we're involved in our high-level salary negotiations. By the way, you didn't lose any strength when the hair came off, did you?
No, it was just too hard. I think we talked about this last week, and I was actually going to text you that night because I felt like I let you down. It's like, oh, you have that great flowing mane. I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't want to have to do this. I'm like, you have to work to get the hair that long. It sort of like really makes you appreciate the dedication of rock stars when it comes to hair. And also hockey players to a degree, Jaromir Jagr. But I got it cut, and I did the stairs, and it was a lot easier. It can't like weigh anything, but it's a heat thing maybe, and I felt like I was Mercury going up and down those BC stairs.
Well, I don't doubt it for a moment. Well, as always, a number of topics for us to cover this week. And in all the time you've been coming on the show, this has only happened a few times, but we're going to talk about a work of art that I don't know much about other than what I can read online, because I have sadly never read James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake.
So you're telling me that I have to be like the center who's going to carry the top line for this particular shift, Kimball? Is that what you're telling me here? And maybe you'll get like a secondary assist. That's fine. We can do it that way.
Well, you've done that for about 4 years, haven't you?
I don't think, maybe you will make people feel more at home, because I am certain, obviously, anyone would be certain, that your experience with Finnegan's Wake is pretty much everyone's experience with Finnegan's Wake. I was thinking today, like, how many copies of this book do you think have been sold since it came out in early May 1939? Probably quite a few copies, because it's one of those books that, oh, yeah, I'll get this smart person book. But then what do you think the percentage is of people who have the book, ever have had the book, that have completed reading the book? I mean, it has to be well less than, like, 1%, right?
I would think so. And I think for me, I think I was too young. I think I tried it in my teens, which, maybe others are prepared for it at that point. This guy was not.
Ulysses was the book that comes out in 1922, and everyone fawns over Ulysses. And Ulysses is a book now that I think for people would be like, what the hell is this? But at the time, when people were better at reading, because reading is a skill. Reading is something that's, in a way, mental, muscular based. It's like it's like the stairs. If you don't regularly run the stairs and you show up after 6 months, you're like, whoa, these stairs are really kicking my ass today. I'm barely making it up the single time. So reading is a lot like that. And I always liken it to like coming in, if you're an outfielder and the ball comes off the bat, your first step has to be back before it's in, right?
Right.
Otherwise, you can't sort of like adjust. And reading is that same way, where everyone sort of takes this step in before they go back, and it's, oh, no, this is over my head. It's going literally over your head, metaphorically over your head. So F. Scott Fitzgerald is showing up, and he's like on Joyce's lawn, and he's on bended knee saying, you are the best, sir, with Ulysses. But Joyce lost virtually everyone, including his brother, when he did Finnegan's Wake, which was 17 years in the making after Ulysses. And he said, Ulysses is a book of the day, and Finnegan's Wake is a book of the night. And what really is clear at night, what's clear in your dreams, what's clear in your nightmares. So it is deliberately obscure in that regard. But there's a very simple technique and a trick I find to reading The Wake. And that's going to sound silly, but very simply, read it. Just read it. Don't try to decipher it. Don't try to, oh, what is this a reference to, this other book that I've never heard of, that kind of thing. Read it, and oftentimes read parts of it aloud. Treat it as you would a symphony, a piece of music, a piece of jazz, an Eric Dolphy or John Coltrane recording. And I think people will find then that it opens up to them in ways and in extra sensory ways that is not going to happen if you sit there trying to pore over it like you would over some online article you're trying to understand in a different kind of sense and way.
And is that, Colin, the best way to approach, well, art that gets labeled as difficult, as challenging? Just read it, just listen to it, just watch it, and appreciate whatever parts of it connect with you.
Everything is case by case, but sometimes as a viewer, a watcher, a listener, we try to do too much. To use a hockey analogy, sometimes being a goalie is letting the puck hit you. Do you know what I mean? It's not trying to do the I'm in the butterfly. It's looking around and, oh, I can't quite see through this screen, and yet I know where the shooter's release point is. So in a way, we know where an artist's release point is. We know what they're endeavoring to do, and we have experienced with their work part of what is coming through to us. But oftentimes, especially with a genius artist, things in their work will work on us almost despite ourselves. And sometimes that can be, it's not just sense, but truth works that way, because we might be loath to have a certain truth enter into our brains because of what it might say about us. But a great work of art by a great artist finds a way to present that truth in a way that you feel like you're in on not the joke, but the truth. And the truth is not something that's meant to be assaultive to you. It's not meant to put you down. It's meant to envelop you and help you, even if it might be causing you to realize certain things about yourself that you might not be keen on. So that's one of the tips, I think, with Finnegan's Wake, is read it as a kind of music. Because if you also read it aloud, which is a very powerful thing that we can do, it will have a sense that comes through in the actual like language of your voice in your ears that, oh, that's what that word means. It's like this kind of, it's almost like when I hear the construction workers outside here in the North End and the things these guys say to each other. You almost need like a skeleton key book to decipher some of these North End expressions. So in really, it's not that different from that. And everyone has dreams. Everyone has nightmares. And you wake up in the morning and you're like, what the hell was that? But you're still able to process it. And I think that's what Joyce is trying to get across in this novel of his of the night.
All right, so I'm a summer reading list now. I'm taking your advice. I shall approach it yet again. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown, and we shift gears to a piece of art that maybe comes at the listener, the consumer, in an opposite fashion, in that it seems simple, but deceptively so, because it's also a great work of art, and that's the Grateful Dead's Ripple.
I've been listening to the Dead off and on for a long time. I mean, I would just have to anyway with part of what I do for my career. But it was only recently, it started around Easter, that I was just hit by the full artistry of this band. Like, I got it in a way that I hadn't gotten it before, which isn't to imply there's actually something to get, but I had reached a point in my life maybe where I was ready to hear something the way it was. And I just was, this is a band about as good as anyone that there's been, like, period. Like, I'm just floored by what they especially did, like, in 1970. And I've been listening to this album that Ripple is on, American Beauty, like, nonstop, and Working Men's Dead from the same year. It's the same bloody year, which is just crazy, too. And you factor in the concerts they're giving. And I know people think, like, well, Bill Walton, he's crazy. Isn't he into the Dead? And these, like, lunatics followed them around and these hippies and everything. And I think, Kimball, you'd probably agree. I might be a very loving person, but I am the furthest there is from a hippie. It's all you need to do is reflect back on our hockey discussions where you're like, injuries are bad. I'm like, no, they're actually pretty good. You should endeavor to injure people. It's like, whoa! It's not very, like, put flowers in your hair, Colin, and go to San... If I went to San Francisco in 1967, I would have had a deep drive to, like, pop people on the sidewalk. So... I'm not someone who you think like, oh, wow, he would. I could have seen myself at a time in my life seriously, I can't even believe I'm saying this, following this band around. That's how transformative this is. It's been like Johnny Dollar for me all over again, but something different. And Ripple is the Dead, I'd say, is their Hey Jude. I cannot, as Fitzgerald said, he could not read Keats's Ode to a Nightingale without crying. I cannot hear this song by the Dead without crying myself.
And the Dead, to me, as somebody, I like them. I'm not passionate about them. Maybe I need to listen more. And yet, while I'm also not likely to follow them or any band around the country, but I've always appreciated their musicianship, and I thought the show, the circus that surrounded them, often obscured that.
These guys, and that's the key word, musicianship, because, for instance, the Beatles. In my view, there's only one musician in the Beatles. That's Paul McCartney. The other, they're rock and rollers. The only musician in the Rolling Stones was Brian Jones. I mean, Keith Richards was a guitarist. George Harrison was a guitarist. John Lennon was a rocker, like that kind of thing. But a musician is someone who like can play all these different instruments and has this awareness, too, of where they fit within a tradition, which isn't the same as having influences. Everyone in the Dead was a musician. And my attitude prior to this year was quite similar to yours. But then I just got deep into these recordings. And Ripple, it's like, I don't even know what you compare it to. I mean, parts of it are like the Psalms in the Bible. But it has this generosity of human spirit to it that, it's just, there's no real artistic analog for it. And it's more economical than something, because you don't think of like the Dead as like hugely economical, but that's a lie. I've really been disabused of that notion. It's more economical than Hey Jude with the extended coda. The Dead have a coda with this song. Jerry Garcia sings it, but he doesn't have to have this coda that goes on as long as McCartney does in that Beatles masterpiece. It's this, these songs are so tight. They're so cohesive. And the notion, too, that this is this jam band and these prolix instrumental excursions, they're really songs within the song. It's just, it's stunning to me that I've come to this so relatively late in my experience with this band, because my attitude was quite similar to yours. And now I'm hearing these songsmiths, this old weird America of Woody Guthrie and the Band and Harry Smith and that famous anthology, and Dylan and Duck Boggs, and these guys understood the musical tapestry of this country in a way that I'm not sure I've heard anyone else understand.
Colin, as I listened to the Dead as a much younger person than I am now, I was always taken with their studio recordings, and boy, there was no better way to earn the derision of those I knew who called themselves Deadheads than by to tell them just that. Oh, I kind of prefer the studio stuff to the live shows. The Ripple is a song that really disappeared from their live set for years.
Yeah. Yes. Well, there are only 11 live versions of it, and you can find them. And it was because, largely because I think that Jerry Garcia couldn't remember the words. It's not just that the words are, they're so distinctive, but they have this kind of unlikely phraseology to them to make them scan, if we were talking about poetry. And we talked about recently in Nick Drake's Brighter Later, and some of his lyrics, if you read them on the page, they look unsingable, I guess. Mm. Sort of like the Star Wars when Mark Hamill said to George Lucas, like, you can write this stuff, but you sure as hell can't say it. But maybe you could write this stuff, and it seems like you couldn't sing it, but you could, so long as you had this different kind of diction and phraseology. So it was not just remembering the words, it was remembering kind of your sonic place within the words, so you could easily go out there and have a crash course if you wanted to. There's even some of it up on my blog on these 11 versions. Like, they're treasured by people. They're not, like, treasured maybe, like, Dark Star is something like that, but the whole iPhone set too, the whole studio live divide, I'm finding now that there's really not that much of a schism between the two. They're doing a lot of the same thing. Sometimes the lengths are different, but it's like saying, like, oh, this book is 230 pages long and this one's 290 pages long. Like, it's, I mean, the book, and what are they doing? And that's really what's going to matter most.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Up next, boy, a movie I love. I haven't seen it in a while, but a great late career performance from Boris Karloff in The Haunted Strangler.
Boris Karloff, he earned his money. He was like 70 years old when he did this film. So if you think about it, he's doing the last of the three Frankenstein films he's in when he's like in his 50s. So that was not an easy role. So this guy had been put through his paces over the decades of his horror career, which is what he was largely known for. And this is kind of like, he made two films in England in the late 1950s where they're sort of like cheap jack films, and it's, you're getting horror maven Boris Karloff, and they do have production values though, and they're well made. And I was struck in watching this again by Karloff's makeup, I guess is what you'd call it, when he is assuming this former identity that he's largely repressed. He's like this kind of milquetoast writer who makes a nuisance of himself by like investigating murders, and he's like bribing the turnkey at this cemetery to go in. He's hunting around for this, oh, they never found the knife type of thing, and he gets this knife in his hand from out of this casket, and lo and behold, transformation kind of scene, and he has a thing, certainly for the strumpets, for the ladies at that point. Ladies who dance the can-can is really this guy's thing. But that cemetery scene is just laden with atmosphere. It reminds me of the beginning of Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, where there's like the whole Lon Chaney being woken up in the crypt type of thing, but just drenched in this atmosphere. It's a really like well-made thriller slash horror film that not a lot of people know about.
And it was part of a double feature that they shot back to back. And the other one I just happened to see recently, Fiend Without a Face, which is okay, but from my perspective, not even in the same league as Haunted Strangler.
Oh, really? I love Fiend Without a Face. I think that's just this one of the great kind of proto-gore films without being gore. The special effects in that film are, I know like the male lead is kind of leaden, but the whole idea of these brains with the spinal cords floating around, they're invisible for a lot of it. So it's like this really kind of clever metaphor of how we're psychological prey unto ourselves. So I think that's actually a really well done, and it's a pretty well regarded film too, and it gets more publicity than this Karloff effort. But I think that's also because it's almost like you have voter fatigue for like the Hart Trophy in the NHL, and people are sick of Boris Karloff, or not that they were sick of him, but you kind of just like, oh, it's Karloff doing his thing, because he worked a lot. These films were certainly not sporadic by any means, but it's just, it's so well done. And I'm trying to, like, I'm freezing the frame, trying to figure out how they managed to make his face, his mouth, look like it does, because he becomes this bogeyman, but he's still recognizably Karloff, but not so much so that you could necessarily ID him. So it's like this strange kind of like gray area in between.
Well, speaking of great late career performances, and I know this is truthful, but it pains me to say it, when you look at the record, Carlton Fisk had a better White Sox career than Red Sox career.
Whoa, Kimball doing takes. Wow. that's really interesting. What makes you, I'm not saying that, I wonder if I agree with you, but let's look at it. He had some Red Sox. Now, he was hurt a bunch with
right.
Red Sox, and those were like his kind of early years. But 1972 and 1977 are flat out two of the best years a catcher has ever had.
Yes.
So he goes to the White Sox. He's like mediocre in 81, although he wins the Silver Slugger. 82, he sucks. 83, he's what, third in MVP with that White Sox team that wins 99 games, but falls against the Orioles, Cal Ripken, Eddie Murray. He's awful in 84. He becomes this like slugger of home runs in 85.
Right.
86, he's bad. They like try to make him an outfielder for some like crazy reason, the left fielder. And then we start getting into these years that are fascinating, that I did not appreciate when I was a huge Carlton Fisk fan, because he's not playing full seasons. And numbers were way down offensively for catchers. Like, if you look at guys who win the Silver Slugger at the time in the catcher position, like, Benito Santiago wins, like, four of them, which is, like, kind of crazy. Lance Parrish, who sucked by this point, wins one in, I think, 1990. So he's not on the Tigers by that point. He's gone from the Tigers to the Phillies, where he failed, but the Phillies didn't want him. And he comes back and he wins it with the Angels. So it was like there wasn't a lot going on. Like Tony Pena was the Yogi Berra of his time. So there wasn't a lot happening offensively for catchers. But Fisk is putting up these huge numbers and really like wide-ranging kind of effective numbers in these shortened campaigns where his OPS and his OPS plus, he's like 900.
He's
having some of the best years of his career. He's like 43.
Right, and we'll never see a catcher put up the kind of numbers, I don't think, that Fisk put up when he was 41, 42, and 43 years old.
He had, I mean, I'd have to think about this some more, but he could very well be the best player in his 40s in baseball history. And he's a catcher. And not only that, he was injury prone, and he had some like bad breaks too, when he was a young man, young in the league anyway, still I guess a young man at this point, but when he was like starting out, he starts late. He's like Wade Boggs. Like he actually appears in 1969. That's technically when he makes his debut in Major Leagues. He wins the Rookie of the Year in 1972. But he's like, whatever, 24 at that point. So he's getting this late start, and it looked like he was going to be this guy who breaks down. And then he had to deal with Don Zimmer. And Don Zimmer's like, you shall catch 157 games a year. It's just, I was going through like Baseball Reference, like doubleheader. Like, yup, he's in both games. So Zimmer tries to kill him in 77 and 78.
Right.
And then he goes to the White Sox, and he's still doing his thing. He's lousy the year he was 45, and they essentially released him. But look at his stats for, like, 1988. It's crazy how efficient this guy was. But I looked at it in a very unnuanced way at the time. I'm like, oh, he doesn't have 25 home runs. He doesn't have 90 RBI. Too bad he sucks now. Well, it's depressing. But he was actually kicking ass, and I wasn't, like, smart or savvy enough to realize it.
Well, yeah, you mentioned that 88 season at 40 years old. 19 homers, 50 runs batted in 76 games, not even a half season.
And what's his OPS? It's like 822 or something, right? It's
yes.
Up there.
919, for God's sakes.
That's nuts. So he's so good in that half season that he wins the Silver Slugger off of that. Now, I mean, like, your competition was like, I mean, I don't even know who your competition was. It was like Rich Gedman was like largely done by then. There just weren't that many, like, remember when Jason Varitek, I think Scott Boris was his agent, and Boris was always like, pay him this amount of money. And it always sounded crazy, but Boris would have these numbers showing how much Varitek, how much better he was. He always had these numbers, too, with, like, J.D. Drew. Then everyone else, like, playing his position, although you thought he was a liability in the lineup. So it kind of speaks to the age you're playing in. It's like Carl Yastrzemski, I guess, winning the batting title in 1968 by hitting .301. He's the only guy in the American League over .300. So, like, you evaluate these things within the context of their era. I guess that's really what Bill Frien's entire Hall of Fame candidacy is based upon, the fact that catchers just, they didn't hit 20 home runs, might as well have been, like, 45 home runs for a catcher. But Fisk wasn't doing this as, like, oh, I will play first base. He's doing this squatting behind the dish. He must have been like a workout freak. So he ends up having, when you factor in all of this, your whole he was better with the White Sox thing, like it gets a little more like a pun here, but more juice to it.
Absolutely. By the way, speaking of baseball, I loved your piece that for some reason, well, we know the reason the publishing world would not pick up, but your op-ed on Major League Baseball and how it could get itself back into a greater level of relevance. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, there's this thing to just when you watch baseball, someone out there, like you watch like an older game on YouTube, and this isn't, again, like some old stuff from back in the day was better, but there is a rhythm, a beat to baseball that the beat is evident, really, in hockey. You can tell, and there's a different beat and a different flow to a playoff game. But there's like a crispness to baseball. There's a beat to it. And I think like when you take that away and it becomes the station-to-station thing and walk around the mound and lace another should-be single to the shortstop who's playing 15 feet to the right of second base, you just stall on that beat and you lose any kind of viewing momentum. Watching baseball, there's even for the viewer, there's this sort of momentum, a rhythm you get into. I find now when I watch like the Red Sox, a lot of the rhythm for me comes from the booth and whatever story Eckersley is going to tell next. So yeah, it was about that kind of idea.
And you're absolutely right. I agree with you completely on the extra inning rule, and I wasn't sold on it at first, but it actually leads to strategy that we don't see in the game these days.
Right, when they put that guy on second base, and it almost like, when I noticed it, it was like, huh, the game is actually without, again, despite itself, is forcing athleticism on its own sport. Where now you have to, it's like when you write fiction. One thing you want to do, you cannot go wrong in doing this. Make characters make decisions. It's compelling. Because anyone else who's reading along says, I wouldn't have done that. I would have done the opposite. He's an idiot. Like, you just, or they think, he did exactly what I would do. I'm a very great person myself. Like, you get into it like that. It's the same thing with sports. It's really not that different. It's narrative-based. Put that guy on second. Right away, a manager has to make a decision. Pitcher has to make a decision. Everything changes. It becomes like, it goes from dead to live, almost. It's like, ooh, we're back. It's like Frankenstein monster coming off the table, reincarnated.
Colin Fleming, every week here on Downtown. Visit his website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog and get your hands on Meathead's Say the Realest Things. Thanks, Colin. Have a good week, and we'll check in with you next Tuesday.
Yeah, take care, guys.